Hello, friends, and welcome to the Healing Ground Movement. Now, for more content and bonus features, you can join us on Facebook and Instagram. And remember, all of our content is delivered freely, so please consider supporting the show by donating via the link on our website at healinggroundmovement.com or liking and reviewing the podcast on your favorite platform.
Enjoy today's episode.
Hey everyone, today's episode is brought to you by the incredible Rad Roller Mobility Tools, my absolute favorite tools for self-myofascial relief for at-home treatment for all aches, pains, and mobility issues. They're an incredible asset to your movement program and care that you're already receiving. Check out the link in our show notes below to get $5 off your purchase of $25 or more. Enjoy today's episode.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Healing Ground Movement Podcast. I am your host, Dr. Carly Hudson, and Jennifer George is with us today covering a very important topic that honestly, I've been having questions come up about this more and more frequently in my office and other podcasts that I have been a guest on, and it's a phase of life that I think many of us young adults are moving into with our parents and ourselves, which is how do we engage in a patient-provider relationship in a way that supports the patient, helps us get the questions we need answered, and if we have a difficult diagnosis, how can we work together with our provider to get the answers that we're seeking? And Jennifer is just the person to answer those questions. She is an award-winning author, speaker, podcast host, and compassion-focused physiotherapist with vast experience in the private and public sectors of care. At the onset of her career, she became a caregiver for her chronically ill father, and it was one of these personal experiences of witnessing his journey through the healthcare system that ultimately shaped her professional practice. She has since spent the last 14 years learning and reflecting on the importance of communication in our health and educational systems. She is a mentor to future and current healthcare providers on discovering their purpose, achieving fulfillment, and creating empowering patient experiences. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Dr. Carly, for having me. I'm happy to be here. I hope I can add some value today to your clinicians' lives, their listeners, and their patients' lives ultimately. So.
Absolutely. Yeah. We have so many patients asking, you know, how can you make sure that you're working with your provider in a way that supports you? And you and I were just kind of joking about this before we hit record, that it's almost like you have to go and get yourself a healthcare degree in order to understand how to be a patient, let alone a doctor or a provider. Yeah. So we're going to be discussing your book, Communication is Care, 9 Empowering Strategies to Guide Patient Healing today. This is a passion project of yours. How did you get into writing it?
It was definitely inspired, and it was a healing project for me too, because I wrote the book after my father passed away. So the premise of the book is basically an educational guide, but it's also a personal narrative of my story and my dad's journey in the healthcare system for over 10 years, in my journey as a caregiver and daughter to him during that time. And what's interesting is that at the onset of my career as a physio, when I became licensed, is when I became a caregiver. So, and his illness kind of sidetracked us. It was nothing. And I mean, I don't know if anyone's ever really prepared, right? We know we're not going to live forever in a way, but my life was very uninterrupted that way. And I was always very mindful and grateful for that. And then my father fell ill kind of suddenly in my end of my first year, second year of doing my master's in physio. And then by the time he came home, I had been licensed and practicing. So everything I witnessed in the healthcare system, interactions especially, had an impact on his outlook and healing and ours as a family as well. Mm-hmm. And so when he passed, there was a sense of urgency. There was like a divine intervention. I want to say it was my dad. It was a few months later. And it was one of those moments where it was like, you need to write this book and you need to write it now. And I always knew I would write a book because I've always loved writing. And I do it kind of as a creative outlet. But I never knew it would be my dad's story. And it came so clearly to me. I was deeply inspired. I knew what the strategies were going to be and laid it out as such. And it took me a few months to write, and then it was published. So that was the end of 2018, and then it was published in June of 2019.
And what a beautiful gift to have come through. And I guess my first question for you is, you know, being in that place of caregiver at that same time you were working on your master's, how did the two tracks influence each other? Did it change the way that you work with your clients and patients? And, you know, what were you able to bring from your own education to your work with caring for your dad?
Yeah. And you know, it's more in reflection. Like the book is really a self-reflection. I don't think I was conscientious of the impact communication had until my father passed and I was reflecting and healing through that. But what's interesting is when he was in the ICU about to start physio, so he got sick in February of 2007. He underwent two liver transplants within a week of each other.
Wow.
And during that second transplant, he was really sick. So they speculated he had a hypoxic brain injury. So he ended up with a seizure disorder. So his cognition ended up being the bigger issue. So on top of his liver transplants and the healing from that itself. So I think it was like May-ish. So February, May-ish, he was still in the ICU and about to start physio. He had a trach. And I was in my second year of schooling, my final year. It was getting close to my graduation. And I thought, well, this will be great. I'll see my dad. And, you know, I get to visit with my dad and I can learn from a professional in the field. And I'll never forget walking into that ICU room and my dad was dangling at the bedside. And there was a therapist sitting in front of him on a stool. And it was quite clear that the therapist was quite frustrated. Mm-hmm. My father was not following any of the instructions. And so I kind of was just observing. And, you know, we had heard a lot of news during that time with my dad. Like there's a lot more to the story and that's all in the book. But basically we went through a lot of highs and lows where people didn't expect him to recover. Medical professionals, we were told the worst of the worst. We were told he would never eat, walk, talk, breathe again on his own, anything like that. So I think that was already kind of, I can't speculate, but I mean, that was maybe what I was sensing from the therapist, because what the therapist had said to me at that time was, you know, I need you to think like a therapist and not like his daughter. Mm. What would you do in this case? Because my dad wasn't able to follow and he wasn't really cooperative. He was resistant a little bit. He was a little feisty. And I mean, he was still in the ICU, delirious. And, you know, there were other factors. When I look back now as a professional, right, with all my years of experience, I understand now. But I remember feeling so caught off guard and I didn't know how to differentiate between the two. How could I not be his daughter too? Like, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I said, the therapist proceeded to say, you know, he's taking the majority of my case low time. And, you know, what would you do in this case? And I looked at the therapist, I looked at my dad and I said, you know, I would continue to treat and I would follow up with the doctor and I would take the direction from the team and continue to work towards the goals. And that was what I said. And my dad actually had a washcloth in his hand and he actually threw it at the time. Cause I think my dad always had a sixth sense. Like he was somebody, he might not have been able to answer direct questions and that kind of thing, but he always had a sense of people. Mm-hmm. And this is what I really want healthcare providers to understand, is it only takes moments to build a rapport or to really, you know, sabotage it, right? I'm not saying you can't recover from that, but you know, we only first impressions really do matter. So, yeah. So that was kind of my introduction, you know? And I remember thinking I wasn't going to practice that way at the time, mm-hmm. like that my practice would look much different.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, I think healthcare providers go into their training, you know, always with the best of intentions that we want to take care of our clients and our patients. We want everybody to have the miraculous turnaround that we dream of, you know, there's an ego piece to that of us being successful, but we want to, you know, we want our work to matter. And there is something that's going through all of the training and all of the education and then seeing the reality of being in the field and that there is a time and money equation. You can get pretty jaded if you don't watch yourself. And I think that I've seen some of the best providers have their own personal story to remind them that there is a real person on the other side of this treatment plan, on the other side of this diagnosis.
Exactly. Yeah, I could totally empathize with a therapist in terms of the caseload demands, and I work in hospital too, so totally empathize. But again, there could have been a better approach to that.
Absolutely.
Right? There always is a better approach, I think. And I mean, I'm not perfect by any means, but that's how we learn, is by recognizing it and mm-hmm. then trying to be present as much as possible and focus on the person in front of us and the life-changing situation that they're going through and empathizing.
No one expects it, and it's not... You don't end up in the ER because, you know, this would be a fun way to spend my
right, like
January.
And myself too, as a student during that time, you know, I didn't want to be there. Like, having compassion for the caregivers, the family too, right? Like, we don't really want to be here 24/7, but we felt we needed to be. So,
yeah. Well, you speak a lot about keeping the channels of communication open, and I think that is something that patients and caregivers alike. Really wonder how do you succeed in building that rapport and having that relationship with your patient throughout the line of care?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think one of the things is to be open in the sense that, so maybe when you're meeting the patient for the first time or for the first interaction at that moment, that maybe you're asking how they're doing, like just keeping it open-ended, ask if they have any concerns, any goals, anything to focus on that they wish to talk more about or work on. And then I also think at the end of the session, it's really important to circle back to that and allow them to ask any questions again. And sometimes conversations are hard, they're not easy. And I think communication, you know, it's often referenced in education as a soft skill, but it's probably the hardest skill because it's always changing and people are different. Every person is different, right? Irregardless of diagnosis. So it's difficult, but I try to keep like my questions open-ended. I ask patients to tell me a little bit more about something. So if somebody, you know, if I'm working with someone and they're standing and they do something like a whoops, or, you know, something felt off to them, I'll ask them more about that. Mm-hmm. So what did that feel like? What felt off to you there? So just really kind of getting as much information as much as possible and allowing them the space to and time to do that and share that if they feel safe enough to.
And what about on the patient side? You know, that I think when we get on that side of the line, that there can be a lot of intimidation, a lot of that white coat worship or fear around it. Sometimes it feels like it's a personal reach to get the gumption and the chutzpah to say what you need to report a whole story. What advice do you have for the patients who feel like they might be oversharing or not sharing enough?
That's a good question. And it's funny because I was talking with Nurse Keith on his podcast, and we were both saying how it would be great to have a communication education for patients and caregivers too, right? Mm-hmm. Rather than just clinicians and, you know, to empower them a little bit more. But I really think it comes down to trusting your sense as a patient, because you have to feel like you can share information with your provider. So if there's something that's making you feel withdrawn, maybe asking yourself what that might be. It doesn't mean it's the provider. Sometimes there's just not a connection there, and that's okay. And I think as providers, we need to get out of our own heads about that as well, you know, and let that go. If it's not there, but just to recognize that that the provider is there for you, your healthcare provider is there for you, and really just sharing what matters to you, what your goals are, what impact that would have on your life. I think it's nice to share things about your life, your family, your social, like maybe outside of just making it feel so clinical sometimes. So that way it's more conversational and not so white coatish, I guess, like you kind of mentioned. I like to add personal touches too. So, you know, if the patient maybe asks for a cup of water or something like that, it kind of, you know, sets the tone a little bit too, to be a little more personalized.
I agree. And, you know, I love that suggestion of adding more personal things about your life and sharing a broader story. You know, sometimes we have providers who get impatient. I know here in the United States, our average patient visit with an MD is about 7 minutes long. And so there can be a lot of impatience around that storytelling. But In my office, those are the stories that give me the most information to be able to talk with my patients. When they're telling me about the weekend they went on with their family, suddenly I get this whole scope about how they used their body, how they were active or inactive in the hurt. And it's usually that little piece of information that directs the treatment plan of, oh my gosh, you go hiking every Saturday. This is the thing that keeps hurting your knee or doing something that we can use that information together, because it was this random story that they, I don't know, just felt drawn to share.
Right.
My favorite sentence is, this probably doesn't matter, but, and I know I'm about to get a really good clue.
But it really does. It's like one of the most important things.
That was the thing.
No, I love that. And I mean, I think a big thing too, especially right now with everything going on, is to ask people, patients who come into your path, how they're coping, how they're, you know, how are they doing with things? And if there's a support that you could offer there, or a referral you could offer if they want any social support on that as well. Very rarely is it just one thing right now that people are dealing with, right? It's multiple things usually. So.
And as we know, stress has so much to do with how our body, how our immune system, how we engage in the world. Our health is not just about, not just about the body. It's body, mind.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, totally agree.
So, you know, you talk a lot in your book as well about finding that space for it. To me, these pieces come together, and correct me if I'm wrong on how I'm reading you, but, you know, having your patients be their own advocates, but also focusing on solutions, not barrier. To me, this creates a bit of a teamwork relationship and conversation where, in a sense, we're co-creating the path forward with our patients, rather than, again, this more old school model of, well, this is what I'm telling you to do. Go do it. And don't fail me.
And you know, and that's not always easy. That was something that we craved as a family for my dad. Like, as caregivers, we were seen more as barriers rather than facilitators to care back then. And this is, again, 2007, 2008 initially. I mean, my dad's care, he lived until 2018. So it was chronic health needs for that whole time. So at an outpatient level as well. But yeah, that's one of my favorite pieces, because that means so much to me. So empowering patients to be, and families to be, their own advocates of care. And I think when we as healthcare providers feel empowered as well in our own practice, have autonomy in our own practice, we can better empower patients and families to also voice their concerns, their goals. And I think giving them the opportunity to do that, inviting them in, is really important, and being visible on that as well. And some patients don't want to, right? Mm-hmm. It's sometimes you're doing a little dance, and that's okay if that's not where they're at. But I think keeping that option there is important.
I agree. And I think it is a harder conversation to have, to encourage a patient to understand the choices in front of them and to make those choices for themselves. I mean, so often when we find ourselves in this crisis situation, or even if it's a long-term chronic situation, the emotional labor, the fatigue of it all becomes a wear down of just saying, well, just tell me what to do. And that can feel like a really kind thing to do in the moment, to take that burden off and say, yep, here's the thing, go do it. But in the long run, that may undermine the relationship or the outcome of care if the thing that you tell them to do is based on the choices and values you would have in that situation, which may or may not be the same as theirs.
Right.
How do you find that juggle around, you know, patients who just want to be told what to do because it's easier, but also the real kindness of, now let's come up with something that really works for this moment in this family.
Yeah. So I think it really comes down to, first of all, they kind of need to be at that point ready to be an active participant in care. You know, I work on an inpatient rehab unit, so my experiences could be different from outpatients too, but, so oftentimes people come to us from acute care. And so acute care is really based in providing care. It's not really rehabilitative so much, right? They kind of get things started. So disempowerment happens a lot of times in hospitals and things like that, where people just get cared upon, and and care is done to them in a lot of ways. And then they come to us, and then we're starting to go into more of an independent progressive approach. And there can be some resistance there, but not intentional. It's more like, wait, now you want me to do what? Like, you know, or you know, and so I have to create a kind of a space or an environment rather where I can show reassurance that someone can do it. Mm-hmm. And make the goals pretty, like everybody kind of comes in with a big goal, right? In my case, patients want to walk, but there are so many things between where they're at and where they want to be that they could still successively accomplish. So I try to break things down leading up to the bigger goal. So empowering patients and family members to be a part of the care and as independent as possible and safe as possible where they're at, mm-hmm. And encouraging them to initiate and take that initiative when it comes to their own care needs and concerns. But yeah, again, not an easy conversation. And it's one that, you know, I often encourage families to have that dialogue too, because sometimes there's a dynamic there that we don't know about. Oh, yeah. Right. And then we start to see that more and more. And, but you know, you approach that with non-judgment and you just try to be supportive and guide as much as you can.
I love that. And you brought up such a good point. And I loved your phrase being cared upon. You're the recipient of, and that yes. This is kind of your job. But you bring that up in the sense that depending on, you know, what area of care you find yourself in, you know, if you're in the emergency room, the expectation of participation in care is going to be very, very different than an outpatient care or your chiropractic office or PT that you elect to do for chronic back pain. You know, we kind of have to meet where we're at within that care realm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had a family member who had a small TIA, a small stroke a handful of years ago. And it was such a small stroke that, you know, we still took her to the emergency room, but she was so cognizant and aware and was, you know, not a little off balance, but really the signs of the stroke were so mild that she was in a place where she wanted to be a participant in her care. But we were in the emergency room in the stroke ward, and the doctors and providers there are used to patients who are generally non-responsive, part of their body is not going to be able to be utilized. And the care that they were familiar with providing was caring upon people in emergency settings. Mm-hmm. And it was really frustrating for this person to need to advocate for the care against an expectation within that office space.
Within that framework. Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
But then going to her continuing care and outpatient care, it was a very different conversation because now it was no longer the emergency room setting. So almost even knowing what office you're in can really set expectations between patient and provider.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I saw that too in my practice privately. And I see that now. And I see that even in long-term care, I worked in long-term care nursing homes for a few years. And I would, you know, some people would be on mechanical lifts for a long time and I would help them not be on mechanical lifts. And that was a hard thing for healthcare workers to wrap their heads around. I was met with some resistance in doing that, but this was their home. And if someone is still improving and can improve and you can maximize their independence and that's what they want, and the families were very much involved, then that, you know, it's for the, we're here for the resident, right? We have to bring it back to that common goal, and the patient, the resident, the client, they're at the center of care and at the center of that team, right?
And I think that that's something that's really important for our patients to remember as well, is that this needs to revolve around your goals and your care plan and finding a provider who is willing to work with you and for you, as opposed to with a protocol and for a protocol, is really going to change your experience.
Yes, totally. Totally. Yeah.
And that's kind of seems like with the getting off of mechanical lifts, even at an age where maybe that wasn't the expectation.
Exactly. And it wasn't. And this was at a time where they started, where physio became more prominent in, in long-term care. And there was more of a restorative approach, which was a great model to bring in. And it was quite fascinating to see some people recover and improve and, you know, I mean, become more independent and, you know, more, more joyful, you know, like just from that standpoint. So healing is always happening, right? We just have to tap into it.
So what would you say as advice for patients who find themselves in that area? And it's certainly where I have found myself before. I have healed through any number of invisible disabilities that I was told under no certain terms would my hearing loss or movement disorders or any of these things ever go away. And they have. How do you swim uphill against the voice of providers telling you what you want is simply not possible before you start believing it?
Yes. So, referring back to my dad too, like that's what we were told. So when my dad had that first seizure after the second transplant, he showed no neurological activity. So the neuro team then became involved and they had an EEG on him, right? And it showed no activity, excuse me. And we were recommended to take him off life support. So the evidence showed that, right? And that was there. And the doctor was very like compassionate. And he was saying, you know, he's got no activity, like quality of life and things like that. And so we, thankfully, the transplant doctor was in the room too. And he's the one who advocated for a couple more days because his liver was doing better. And that's what we did. So we actually asked for more time, obviously. And a couple days or that night, actually, he started to show signs of recovery. So as clinicians, we have to, even though it's important for us to be evidence-based, evidence-informed, there's still a human being that in a family and a person, you know, that you're still working with. And we can't be totally on one side, I think. We have to take in the big picture and the full picture and, and just kind of adapt and respond to that. So had the transplant surgeon there advocating, we would have probably followed the recommendation and we probably wouldn't have gotten 11 extra years with my dad, right? So you just never know. And I think we should never take hope off the table. We shouldn't mislead either, right? Or give false hope. But I think it's important to not take hope off the table either.
Oh, I love that. Not to take hope off the table. And because there is always that space. I love the evidence informed. I mean, there's research, but the research can always only go so far. We are all so bio-individual and the research, no matter what it is you're looking at, is trying to create the most homogeneous interpretation of anything. And it doesn't leave room for that outlier that gets swept under the rug to make a neat and tidy paper.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, there was no, at the time, there was no real reason as to why he had the seizure. Like they couldn't answer that really. So they didn't really know. And I mean, to this day, a lot of the providers at that time referred to my dad as a medical miracle. Like so not every case is like this and I get that. But again, I do think it's important to take in the big picture and never take hope off the table because you just never know.
Well, and from a patient perspective, then to me, that struck me was this idea of having that one provider kind of hold on to that space of hope. And that's where getting your second and third opinion becomes so, so useful that you have someone who maybe had a slightly different experience or has been educated in a slightly different lens. Maybe, you know, it is more of a functional versus pharmaceutical base. Any of these kinds of pieces is going to change the way you interpret outcomes as well.
Exactly.
And the more perspectives you have, perhaps the clearer path through that you might develop.
Exactly. And I think too, as clinicians, I might be getting ahead a bit too, we focus on outcomes so much and we're trained to do that, but we also have to consider the experience and the not just the outcome, but the process of things and recognizing the progress in that and recognizing how that's going. And that often can guide you towards the outcome, right? So if someone's outcome is just pain, well, okay. So there's other things that we could look at along the way as well, in addition to that, to see if we're on the right track.
Yeah, let's tease that apart a little bit because it's certainly a piece that I've been reading and listening more to lately, which is, at least I start to see two camps of people almost in my patient base, which is, you know, quality of life on this earth or quantity of life on this earth. Mm. And there are very different outcomes and very different paths to get to. You know, someone might say, I don't care if this intervention is going to hurt. I don't care if I'm going to be in chronic pain my whole rest of my life, so long as I have more of that rest of my life. And another patient may say, well, I don't want to live another 5 years if I'm in 7 out of 10 pain every single day of them. Give me what good I have left. I don't think that we really bring up that nuance so specifically when we talk to our patients and say, you know, these are the outcomes and this is the pathway to the outcomes that we can have. How can we start to understand that a little bit better, both from a patient and provider?
Yeah, I guess it comes down to understanding your patient's perspective, right? Like, so even just knowing that that's the perspective they're coming from, I think that's what guides you, not the perspective. And I think that's what empathy is all about, right? It's not from the perspective you would come from. It's from the perspective that they are coming from, that you are trying to understand. And I don't think there's anything wrong with saying, you know, and I say this often, like, I can't understand what you're going through. I will say that, or what your pain's like, because I haven't been through it like you have, but I'm here with you and I'm here to support you, and I will do, you know, what I can to help you. And sometimes too, for that one, like for example, like if someone's in chronic pain and their function's limited, let's say, you know, so certain movements are limited, I often sometimes help them to change their perspective from pain to function. So, you know, rather than just focusing on the pain, you know, look how much more movement you've gained, or look at the impact now that this has had on your life. And I find that sometimes the pain becomes more secondary, but it's still there and you're acknowledging it, right? You're not telling them to ignore it. You're not being insensitive to that, but it doesn't become the focus maybe so much. And that's where the empowerment comes in too, where you're empowering patients to take control over their life again. But making them aware that you're with them along that yeah. path, right? Yeah. Well, not just there giving them knowledge and expertise.
Yeah. And I like that change of lens, because it does open up to what are other measurements of health and life? Yeah, we hear so much about pain. And if there's any discomfort, we start to think that if there's any discomfort, that it shouldn't be there at all. Yeah. But if we can think about the functionality or independence or other goals that we might have where it's a little bit of a trade-off. Yeah, and for someone else, the trade-off might be, I really don't care if I'm not terribly functional. I just don't want to have any pain. But again, that's that individual choice. And it would be very different treatment plans for these different people. You know, if someone doesn't want to experience any pain, their exercises are going to be different than someone who wants to have functionality but might have to grow through some discomfort to get there.
Right. Yeah. And I've seen a variety of both, right? Like, and I know you have as well. I was just recently sharing a story that I recalled from earlier years of my practice working in outpatients, but I had a patient come to me that was in therapy for a year with chronic back pain from an injury, a work-related injury, I believe. And the doctor referred the patient to our clinic and was kind of like, can you help me, basically, right? Like, I've been in therapy for a year. My pain is still like excruciating. So, you know, we did the assessment. I didn't see any like flags, anything sinister. And I kind of reassured the patient on that. And I, by the end, you know, I looked at the bigger picture, looking back, you know, I recognized that they were isolating from friends. They weren't doing things around the house that they once enjoyed doing, like little renovations and things like that. Like their world was really getting smaller and their anxiety was growing. And I could see that as we were doing the assessment and we were chatting and stuff. And so finally I acknowledged that at the end. And I said, you know, I believe I can help you. I said, you know, I understand you're in pain. But I'm not going to chase that pain. I think we'll manage it, but it won't be the focus of your treatment. You know, this was someone in their 30s. And I said, you know, I'm here to help you also get back to your life again, because that's really what you're telling me is what I'm understanding. Yeah. And at first the anxiety was like looking at me like, what do you mean you're not going to like chase my pain away? Like we had been together for about an hour, so we had a decent rapport. And I said, you know, just trust me and let's try it. Like, I mean, and there were other things things in the treatment plan from the other therapist that I recognized there were gaps in. So we talked about that. And I said, you know, I think this is partly why maybe you are still in pain because of the gaps here in this treatment plan, perhaps, that we can fill in. And yeah, just within a few weeks, they were more independent. They were independently carrying out their exercises. You know, we became less about managing pain. They knew how to manage pain on their own. And it was quite successful. And it was probably one of my favorite outpatient moments when I worked in outpatients, because yeah, it's just amazing when you change perspectives a little bit and you support them along the way, what can result.
I love that. It's such an incredible story. And I think it's one that is going to resonate with a lot more people than in this, you know, last year, 6 months, 9 months, than perhaps a few years before that.
Yeah.
I certainly see that with my patients after having been so isolated through, you know, there were so many different measures taken throughout the pandemic, but at some point, almost everyone had to go through a place of isolation or not being able to go into work, not being able to go yeah. and do their hobbies and activities. And the amount of slow wearing breakdown on a body and on an emotional, mental level really started to show up in the treatment room. Yeah. And chasing the pain was not as effective as empowering some more of that independence, especially as things started to change and we progress along to, you know, the state that we're in now where we can go back out and do things safely.
Right.
That is such an important focus and goal, as much as making sure you do your exercises 3 times a day, so many reps.
Yeah, exactly. And that's basically what they were saying, was that, you know, I want my pain to be gone so that I can get back to work, so that I can get back to life again and be social again. And, you know, and that was what I was understanding. And so when I just put that out there, it was like, oh yeah, but it wasn't, you know, it was met with some resistance, but it was more like, okay, let's see, you know, I respected that. I appreciated that. And that was what we did. And, thankfully, you know, they stayed with me and we got there.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a leap of faith for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're taught so much, manage pain, then go back, when
right.
it really is a side-by-side journey of reduce a little pain, bring in a little more life, reduce a little pain, bring in a little bit more life until yeah. that you know, have the freedom and independence that you're looking for.
Exactly. So kind of coexisting with it. Mm-hmm. But not letting it control you at the same time. And again, this is assuming that those flags have been ruled out, right?
Yeah. No red flags, no big scaries, but
yeah, exactly.
There's so much chronic pain in the world that, you know, most of us are living with it without any big red flags.
Yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. So I think that encouragement that I was providing at the onset was helpful to say, mm-hmm. you know, I don't, like, this injury happened over a year ago. It's already healed, you know, from a mechanical lens. Mm-hmm. So now we can get back into function and, you know, integrating back into life again. So
that's such yeah. a wonderful perspective. And you know, giving that education about what your body is doing and what is damage versus what is discomfort exactly. is a really big conversation to have as well.
Yeah, definitely. And you'll know when, as a clinician, you'll know when you can have those conversations, like mm-hmm. you said, in those two different scenarios, right? I think that person was at the point where they just wanted to be functional again and yeah. was in pain, right? And just needed that someone to just guide them back. So, yeah.
So for our patients, it really is having that space and having that clarity of what are your goals, what is important to you, mm-hmm. and making sure that you can have that conversation with your provider where you're having treatment goals and plans that circle back to what is important to you. And if their outcomes don't seem to match your goals, then that's time for another conversation or another provider.
Right, exactly. And like you said, just coming back to that, I know, again, I can think of another quick story to reiterate too, along that line. So I have had a patient who kind of was having falls and stopped mm-hmm. basically walking because they were having falls. So kind of got worried, right? And ended up wheelchair bound in home to protect themselves. And again, their world became a little smaller. came to our hospital with the goal of walking again, you know, at a household level, at least, was very realistic about it and actually had very good potential. And it was very encouraging. I'm like, you know, you have great potential. The moment we would get to the point where we would initiate that step, it was like so much fear there pulling back. And I would have to say, you know, remember what you told me what your goal is. You know, what was your goal? You know, I'd have to remind the patient because the fear was so strong. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, and I'm letting you know that I know you have the potential to walk, that you have the potential to take this step. So, you know, if you could trust me with that, like, so it was, you know, again, making them mindful of what the goal is, right? And keeping them accountable to it as well. So, and we, you know, she got there as well with some time, but it was a lot of looping back to that. To mm-hmm. that goal, making her, you know, reminding her of that, because when you've closed that off for 2 years, like, you know, it's of course it's nice to be able to do it again, but the work that goes into that is not so easy after 2 years, right? So, understandably, yeah.
All good things take that kind of work, take that kind of conviction.
Exactly, and time, yeah.
What a beautiful story. What a very optimistic note. And in that vein, you know, we have, so Jennifer has gifted us with a copy of her book, Communication is Care. So we're going to do another Instagram giveaway. Look for that on our Instagram Healing Ground Movement. Make sure that you like, tag, and comment. And win your very own copy and go through these 9 empowering strategies to guide patient healing, to advocate for yourself, a family member, if you're a provider, to work on that communication aspect as well. Mm-hmm. And then Jennifer, for all of our listeners who want to learn more about the work that you do and hear more from you, where can they find you?
They could find me on my website. So it's jennifergeorge.co. So that would have like my podcast on there, my book, and it also have upcoming events, publications, and my social media outlets are on there as well.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for joining us today and sharing such amazing insight, as well as some really great provider stories to really illustrate the point. I think it really brought it home.
Thank you so much, Dr. Carley. And thank you so much for what you're doing to inspire others, patients, and providers through your story and your work. So thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I thank you. And for that jumping off point, the relationship that we have with ourselves, with our goals, and with our provider, to me, that has become the biggest guide point to how we heal and the success we have in care. Yes. Our success is only limited by our own gumption, creativity, and unfortunately, sometimes our pocketbook. But, at least we can control 2 out of the 3.
Absolutely. Love that.
But to all of our listeners, I hope that there was a little bit of empowerment, a little bit of a different perspective on how to go about your own healing, how you engage with your care providers. And for our providers listening, maybe a reminder of some of those empathetic reasons why you became the phenomenal provider that you are today.
Yes.
We will see you all next week for another episode of Healing Ground Movement. In the meantime, be well.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to today's episode. I hope you enjoyed what you heard and got a little something out of it to help you on your journey to health. Please, if you're inclined, share this podcast with a friend so we can help more people lead healthier lives. Now remember, the information expressed in these interviews is for informational and not diagnostic or treatment purposes. However, I hope you find that having the right information and resources can go a long way to helping you on your healthcare journey. Ask the right questions and seek out professional help. And we'll see you next week for another episode of the Healing Ground Movement podcast. Be well.